You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and RadioCafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. We're going to be talking today with a wonderful poet named Tim McLaughlin, who has a new book and also has some amazing stories about his life as a writer, as a poet. He's very much grounded in nature, and one of his goals for his poetry is what he calls rewilding the human heart. Stay with us. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Funding learning initiatives and community programs, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. And many thanks to the Lanham Foundation for support of the Radio Cafe. I'm very happy to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Tim McLaughlin. He's a poet, and his new book, released just this week, is called Seeds Under the Tongue. For those listeners in the Santa Fe area, he will be doing a book release on Sunday, the 21st of July at 4 o'clock at the Scottish Rite Theater in Santa Fe. Welcome, Tim.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure, as always, to be here with you, Mary Charlotte.
It's a wonderful book and very much grounded in nature, in the spirits of nature, in your own lived experience. And I was thinking as I was reading it that this kind of thing could be so cheesy, not in the right hands, but because you are such an expert wordsmith and because the material is so deeply lived and felt, it really works and is a very, very powerful book. And one of the themes, I think, is taking what is so fundamentally nonverbal, namely one's interaction with the outdoors, with nature, with sky, with plants, with animals, and translating that into language. Mm-hmm. Talk about that process a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I would say if anything, the poems are very honest because they are coming directly out of that lived experience in the wild, you know, and all of the writing is done there in the mountains or, you know, in the wilderness, away from you know, domesticity and modernity and all of these things, although still there's the tether, but I go through a deep process each week going into the wild and getting into a state of mind and heart whereby the language can shift into what I feel is poetry or the type of poetry that comes through me in response, in dialogue, in conversation with what you just said, the spirits of the earth and all the presences there. So in some sense, I've been learning over the course of 20 years at least, since I first moved to, when I was 22, I moved to Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, you know, and changed my life completely from an East Coaster growing up in the Washington, D.C. area. And, you know, I was introduced to a perspective and cosmology of animism, you know, and that everything is ensouled and alive and responsive and intelligent and communicative. And so over the years, I'm wanting to give voice to that, you know, and trying to bring, in some sense, more humans into that same felt experience of the animate world, you know, and what is that language and how does that language come through the poet that might be different from the Lakota traditionalist, you know, someone who did grow up in the modern world but is deeply taken and given to the earth. And if anything, that's, you know, that's really the thread that moves through all my poetry is just the deep commitment, but ecstatic, enjoy, you know, deeply enjoyed love relationship with the natural world, which includes us as humans.
Would you like to read, or in your case, you've memorized a lot of your own work, recite a poem?
Yes, yeah, I would love to. Yeah, I do love to embody them and recite them. And that's part of what I do when I'm in the mountains.
So you do all your writing, your composing, when you're in the mountains? Like you bring a pen and paper out there?
Yeah, pen and paper. The initial draft, you know, is done there. And then I'd use computers like any other writer today. But then I'll print what I've, you know, come up with in the second draft and bring it back into the wild. And then that becomes the second blush, you know, and the new edits. And then with many pieces, I wish it were all of them, I get to that last stage of embodying and really fully learning it. And for me, that's where the last tweaks come in, because by sounding it out without the paper, I can literally feel where something might need to be tightened or changed or dropped out completely. And I love that piece of it, because it's like there's always something to do. You know, there's never a point of nothing.
Well, let's hear a poem.
Okay. This one's for the moon. You, moon, born of earth, you sprang from her belly in a shudder the stars still talk about. You sailed out and fastened true beside your earth mother, who began birthing babies from every cavity, a wild tangle of tree and grass of every sort angling up under sun's steady gaze. Now, beyond that origin tale, I only know what I have seen, and keep glancing up to uncover more of who you are, old moon. My tongue often betrays me as I try to call to you, not knowing if I should croon or intone devotions. Your shimmery glow dizzies and confounds my deciding mind. There are nights, I confess, that I open my jaws to snare and consume you like a luminous wafer, still hungry for the light promised to me in church. Other times I feel it's me that's eaten, drowned in your silver, then steamed in your star-fired pots and speared on your dark fork. Each month, I shyly watch as you grow, day after day, then night after night, to a stunning fullness, like a pale breast slowly revealed down to the nipple, fiended for, then turned from when the sight overwhelms. And many times, moon, I spot you floated above, and like a cool glass of water presented, stop to drink you in a minute, and feel into what the tides and my wife are always knowing without a word told of it. And when I'm deep in the mountains, and the skies darken until your glimmer becomes my everything, I can just feel sun's heat bouncing from you, softly licking the back of my neck, doctoring me through you, moon.
Tim McLaughlin from the new book, Seeds Under the Tongue. And one of the things that struck me in this poem and reading so many of your poems is this incredible reverence for, quote unquote, the feminine. And I get very skittish talking about using that kind of language, but it's sort of all we've got. And also the masculine, and those are kind of archetypes that are found in nature, in ourselves, in our bodies, and we also project them onto things that are not technically masculine or feminine, like the moon.
Right.
And I wondered, you know, there's been so much sort of, again, cheesiness and cliche around those things, but there's also so much power, and I wondered sort of how you think about all that.
Yeah, I mean, it is a slippery slope in some ways, you know, the temptation to sort of anthropomorphize everything. And yet, you know, being human, we relate everything through the lens of humanity. And for me, you know, sinking into femininity or the feminine principle as a non-human energy and truth is really important and has been very significant to me on my journey just as a husband, you know, and a father, and as a poet, you know, and to understand, as poets have forever, to sort of understand the earth as a mother and a woman or a grandmother, all these things, but to sort of always know, you know, we're not really talking about a human here. We're talking about something that's so large and is going to take every kind of feminine form and masculine form, you know. And I mean, one of the things that this poem, I guess, is a good example of that, is that as I've deepened over the years with my relationship with the wild, there's a movement past the initial euphoria and just the pleasure of, you know, being out of our busy world and being in the freshness of nature, and what can turn into, you know, what I would call sentimentality, and this is what you're touching in on, and getting to a place of not fearing nature, not going back to that at all, but really reckoning with, if you are going to talk about an earth mother, that she's not just chaste Mary, you know, she is like this fierce medicine woman, you know, with wild hair and broken teeth, who survived everything and will survive anything humanity comes up with, you know, and honors life above all. So there's no sentimentality in the earth needing to do exactly what needs to happen to be well. And I believe in that, even in the midst of our ecological peril and crisis, you know.
Well, there's a very kind of moving and vulnerable poem about how you basically can't protect your children, no matter how much you want to.
Right.
And there are these bombs, and there are these crazy people, and these nuclear warheads, and these triggers, and these people who have no relationship with the wild anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, and I, again, here's an example where I was sort of looking at that as a father, but also relating it to the relationship between sun and earth. That there's the sun just, you know, giving love energy, whether it's fatherly, motherly, or otherwise, you know, just fully opens to this planet and the solar system every day, and yet can't stop, you know, whatever's happening to his daughter, if you want to put it in that
right.
framework, right? The earth is doing what it's doing.
There's a section, and this poem that you just read, You Moon, is the last poem in that section called Church. And So you have a nice Irish name, McLaughlin, and you come from Catholicism. And there's both, in moments, some reverence toward that and a kind of leaving behind of the way in which that religion has been domesticated and put indoors and kind of lost its wildness.
Yeah. And also the language, you know, by which that religion has operated and the type of poetry it uses and all of, you know, I'm sort of breaking out of the container of all of that, you know, the church itself, the structure, the system. And there are some poems in that section that are from, you know, earlier in my writing life as well, that I had not yet published, but in this book, it's a very vulnerable book, you know, and raw and open, and you know, that's part of it, is the relationship with the Roman Catholic tradition, and you know, I was lucky enough to be sort of presented the Lakota indigenous tradition when I was very young, and for a while there, I was trying to hold both together, you know, and it's almost like having two marriages or something. At a certain point, it just wasn't going to work any longer, and I had to make a clean break and you know, move into the more indigenous. And you know, largely for me, that was a lot about wanting to know what my ancestral line was doing earlier than 2,000 years ago. You know, it's like that hunger for something a little richer and deeper, and respecting, yes, the tradition of Christianity, but also, you know, in a beautiful, loving way, calling it out on so many atrocities and injustices and continual systemic dysfunction. And, you know, I can't be silent about those things at this moment.
There's a poem in which you describe going to Ireland and feeling very deeply rooted there. Was that kind of more the ancient Ireland?
Yes. Yeah, I was on John O'Donohue's land, actually, where that huge experience happened to me. And it very much was, just, again, an increased sensibility and attunement to, like, the connection to that land. And it's not a dreamy, you know, romanticized thing. It was affecting me very, very deeply. And so I had to, in that moment on his land, I felt I had to, I was just gazing out at the ocean, you know, looking to where the next stop would be Boston, you know, and saying, what was it like for these people to just sort of go to America, you know, and go into much, would be much like my son saying, I'm going to Mars, you know.
Right.
I'll never see you again. But it what rose in me was to sing a Lakota song there and to say to my ancestors, kind of, this is the purest thing I can tell you that I carry from that land where we went a while ago. You know, is this thing from that other continent, is this song of the indigenous people there. And it was a beautiful and incredible experience because it hadn't rained in several days, and that's unusual in Ireland. And as I was singing, the thunder came, you know, and that's the most powerful response in the living environment in the Lakota cosmology, and it had never happened to me before. So it was so deep that I needed to bring it into into a poem and into the book. But again, this is the example of the kind of things that I'm sharing that are so raw and vulnerable that I was almost afraid to share them, but I'm stepping out and saying, I want to do this.
One of the things that was so interesting to me about the church section was you paint a picture, and I don't know if you want to read one of those or recite one of those or not, but you do paint a picture of a kind of, in one of the poems, like the church structure, which is stone and cold, and the water is not flowing, it's becoming
stagnant
in putrid. its little pools, and you know, in their little basins, and the light of day and the breath of wind isn't coming in. And then you focus on what I in my mind call Jesus the outdoorsman.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of the path that you followed, not the path of scripture and
Correct.
Cathedrals, but the path of being in the desert.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the relationship with Jesus, I think, has actually opened up for me as a result of as I said, leaving the church, you know, because he's essentially a wild indigenous man who was mostly barefoot and telling stories. And, you know, there are other humans that I model myself after, but he's certainly one of them, you know. And that's bold and paradigm shifter and amazing, incredible person. But as a result of like sitting in the desert for long periods of time, I mean, to me, he's a big, big ceremonialist, and the Lakota understand him that way too, you know. Even the crucifixion, it's a very big ceremony. And after having been a sun dancer, I understand that. That event, the power of that in a more embodied, visceral way. I'm with it with my heart, you know.
There's a story that you tell at the end of the book. It's not a poem. It's a piece of prose where you explain something that happened to you when you were out on a walk on a sunny winter day where with a little sort of snowstorm in the horizon or whatever, and suddenly you were enveloped by a cloud and get horribly lost.
Mm-hmm.
What happened? Can you tell a little bit? Do you mind telling that story?
Well, this is what I understand now is my initiation as a poet, and what after that I have called earth poet or wild earth poet. Instead of an MFA program or some other way of being formed as a poet, this is what happened. And as I say in the book, I tucked that story into the very back, you know, because again, it's private, and yet it informs the rest of it, because that was such a deeply powerful and painful experience, that you can see how this language is coming out of that, that lived experience where, you know, for years I'm sort of praying to the earth saying, I want to be, you know, useful. I want to be, you know, one of your mouthpieces as a poet. And little did I realize to make that deepened connection and relationship with the earth, I would have to be taken overnight. So it became lost in this blizzard, you know.
In January,
last day of January in 2015. I'll never forget it. And, you know, it became clear to me. And again, thank all the spirits that I have this path that I've followed of ceremony, Lakota ceremony, because I know how to sort of, in my mind and heart, like hold the arc of a big ceremony. And so I immediately, when I realized I was not getting out and search and rescue was not going to find me before darkness, that I would probably be out there all night and that there was no chance of a fire because everything was ice. I tried. I even started to build a shelter, you know, an ice shelter, but it was also sleeting, snowing. I was so wet that if I stopped moving for more than 30, 40 seconds, it was very dangerous. I was shaking violently.
And you were in the bottom of a canyon.
I was in the bottom of Pacheco Canyon, you know, and locals here know the Tesuque Creek and that beautiful area, but heavy, heavy snow. And I had gone up and down scrambling and, you know, doing things that after a while became dangerous, trying to find my way. And I eventually just had to stop and plant myself. And in my mind, I was on what we call a hamblecha or a vision quest. And I just, you know, the circle sort of formed itself around me. And I said, I'm staying here until dawn. Never took my snowshoes off and just started dancing. And I sang all the songs that I know in Lakota. I recited all the poems that I have. I just was able to kindle the fire inside of myself. And what was looking very grim and starting to go towards, you know, possible or...
You thought you might die.
Yeah, it was, as a wilderness instructor, that mind was saying, you have to have fire or some other living body to warm you, or else you will not survive the night. That's what my rational mind said. And so the ceremonial mind had to come in and say, there is another possibility here, and you can expand past that one equation, and by dancing and then singing and not reserving my energies, but singing with everything I had, all of a sudden I can feel my fingers coming back and my feet coming back, and that I'm warm, and that a sense that I can do this. I will be able to survive this night.
That was a long night.
Yeah,
I mean, it get more than 12 hours of darkness at that time of year.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it was about 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. that I danced. Now, that I had never done. I've done a lot of ceremonies, but you know, you have breaks and things like this. So I didn't even know it was possible for my human body to be in motion like that for that long.
Did you have any food?
I had a tiny bit of food left, but I never touched that because to me, it was like, I'm in ceremony and I've got enough in that regard. I did, you know, drink a little water and occasionally put some snow in my mouth to keep hydrated. But largely it was just really releasing that one conclusion and coming into another sense of there is life force being given to me because I'm opening myself so widely, you know.
Now, during this dancing and singing, were you moving up the canyon or were you staying in place?
No, like I said, I locked myself in, and you know, in Vision Quest, you're in a circle. You know, yeah. It's defined by prayer ties and other things. So in my heart, I could see it form around me invisibly, and I just felt, that's your place. You stay there. And I knew that, and I was sounding. Search and Rescue was out there. They were also sounding. We actually could hear each other, but there was no way for them to access me. But I had a feeling, you know, they know I'm here and I have to make it till dawn, and I can.
And so what happened when the sun rose?
The sun rose and I felt that circle opened and I could move, and I still wasn't sure if I would get help or if I needed to get myself out. So I started to move, and I was kind of cresting up on a ridge again, and then I eventually saw what I'll never forget, but the bright red jacket of the president of the Santa Fe Search and Rescue, and that crew of four who bivouacked for several hours but stayed out through the night and were with me. And I mean, these people did not look like humans to me. They looked like angels or something like that. And they were very surprised that I was in such good condition, actually.
Once you came out and you'd finished that kind of ceremonial, I don't know whether to call it trance or whatever that experience was, were you then like incredibly tired and you know, I don't want to say close to death, but I mean, did that life energy then leave you, or yeah. How were you?
Yeah, I was pumped with, you know, what I said, the sheer resolve that had been pumped through me through the night was still sort of reverberating and vibrating in me as I, you know, conducted this interview with Search and Rescue, as they need to take their notes and all that. And I drove myself home, I don't know how, and then literally made it through the threshold of my door and collapsed in the feet of my wife, who embraced me. And they had held a fire all night waiting and hoping, and my children were there. And
right.
Yeah, so it took a while to heal. I can still feel, actually, some pain in my lungs from all the cold air of that night, and it was a big thing.
And that was your initiation into poetry, although I've had you on the air a number of times in the past, and you certainly have been a wonderful poet for many years. What changed with that 2015 event?
Yeah, so that's, you know, that's the difference between, I mean, not practicing, but knowing you're a poet, you know, and apprenticing to it, you know, and then giving yourself like completely marrying. Maybe it's like the remarriage after you know what marriage looks like, you know, like really committing to what I call it an altar, you know, the altar of poetry, that I am completely committed to this, and that I'm being given a blessing, you know, that the earth is saying yes. And in fact, if we didn't say yes, we wouldn't have taken you, you know. It wasn't a superfluous thing. It's not like just
snatching. It wasn't random,
you.
Yeah.
It's not random at all. And there's so many other things to say about it, but it's sort of like, you know, midlife crisis and, you know, and men in particular, we need some sort of big initiation into our purpose. So this was a confirmation of, you know, you need to continue to live in this way. And there's a lot more territory that you are just now being introduced to. There's a big door opening to you about all of nature, you know, the darkness and the light, and that you're going to be a voice for humans coming back into right relations as best we can.
One of the things that happened that night, and one of the things that's evident in a lot of your poems, is this whole thing of listening to nature. And it turns out, I mean, nature, I don't know what the word is, wildness, earth, everything out there that's not cities and, yeah, you know, domesticity. And you are there, you speak, you listen, and if you are quiet enough, there's all kinds of things that you hear and that come back to you, mm-hmm, that are not available to, and this is in no way dissing scientists, but it's not available to scientists who are treating nature more as matter, at least when they're doing their work,
yeah,
and as specimen and as classification, and you kind of allude to this in some of your poetry, but this is a very different kind of relationship.
Yeah. Yeah, again, it's animism, you know, and I think the place to start, and that's part of what this book does, is to say, you know, it's okay to, as I just did, directly address the moon or the elk or the flower in English, in our human language, and to say that, you know, yes, it's the words and the poems, but it's really the sort of felt opening, you know, the way you open to your dogs and your, you know, the things we love, and that if anything, that's what I'm doing. And hopefully it's useful to other people to say, I deeply feel and engage with and refresh this loving relationship with all of the earth. And all the various things, you know, there are all these conversations. And then in this book, you know, I'm giving, it's bold, but I'm giving voice to some of those things, you know, allowing bear and pine tree and the river to speak again in English. But I really tried to go in, and again, informed by what I've learned from Lakota people, to allow that voice to really come through as best I can do, you know, and voices of spirits and this sort of thing. And you know, it's a starting point, I think, for people to just go in and yeah, use some language. And if you want to start by you know, saying she and thinking of the flower as a sister, then that's great, because it does, it moves you past that scientific mind that we've all sort of been given, and we're scared of being criticized for not using that safe, approved framework. And yet this other one is it's so life-giving, and it's so real too, because in your own way you will feel and hear, may not be in language, you know, but the response. And it's amazing, as soon as people open up and they're like, well, all of a sudden the aspen started swaying like this. And it's like, of course, the living environment. I mean, don't we know that with our domestic animals, you know, our energies are responded to.
You are, as you're talking about, deeply influenced by your time with Lakota people. And then you worked here at the Santa Fe Indian School for some years and did incredible work with the young people there, with the students. I heard a performance, saw a performance that they did under, you know, under your direction at the mm-hmm. Lenzic some years ago, and you produced a CD. I think it was Microphones and Moccasins.
The opposite. Moccasins and Microphones.
Moccasins,
yes.
And Microphones. which was moving to the point of, I mean, it was stunning. It was a stunning piece of work you did. You're very much inside of that North American, Native American set of traditions and influences, and you are an Irish guy with blonde hair and a beard. Has there been any tension about that? You know, people are so sensitive, extremely sensitive sometimes to quote-unquote cultural appropriation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, what I've learned, Mary Charlotte, over the years is that, and maybe this is obvious, but the tension lives in you, and then it is responded to outside of you. You know, sometimes there's going to be criticism just because there's something living in that person who's critiquing. But I've felt, as I've become more comfortable knowing what it is I'm doing and how I'm doing it with integrity, and I answer to what I call the spirits, you know, I answer to the earth, and I know that it's authentic. I'm not putting on something else. And in fact, the Irish poets are so what we call indigenous, so very indigenous. And if you ever read poetry that's in the Irish language, I mean, all I can do is read it in English translation, but it's so much like the kinds of things I heard Lakota elders speak. And I think that's why I actually felt more comfortable in Pine Ridge, being, you know, the one blonde person among a sea of beautiful brown-skinned people, than I did in Washington, D.C., where there wasn't that same type of language or sensibility and a cosmology that just sort of landed and made me feel like, okay. And now I understand the okay was about linking back to the old poets of Ireland and what it is that I feel connected to.
Would you like to give us another poem?
Sure. How about, I'll do this one. We had a storm last night in Santa Fe, a couple nights ago, wasn't it? And this is called Storm Song. Nowadays, I go into the wild, especially when the weather is what some call bad. Nowadays, I go into the wild, especially when the weather is what some call bad. Charged, I say. Ripe, I say. When the sun is clouded over, an enchantment falls over the land, and the animal of me awakens with ferocity. My eyes enlarge and lock in, becoming more than they were in the edgy focus of city life. I know the thunders are gathered above for good purpose, and a heightened presence tremors in everything as the first drops or flakes float to the forest floor. Straight away, I'm on the move, darting through smooth-bodied aspens, edging along thin stream banks, leaping and scurrying and crawling through the landscape in a playful dignity that was slow siphoned out of me in theater seats and on leveled streets. A playful dignity that was slow siphoned out of me in theater seats and on leveled streets. Oh, now I'm drumming on my bones again. Ah, my shrieking laughter bellows and ripples in the wind. I grunt and growl like the beasts whose trails I follow and abandon at will. Is this boyishness? Or have I turned the old fool already? I stop beside a rare pool in the shallow waterway to hear the mother waters sing their storming chants. In the soothe of those liquid tones, I feel my children feeling me and sink into my middle agedness. My God, what precious untamed beings! To think my lady and I called them here, and the call rang true, still shakes me to the core like hauntingly near thunder music. For them, I am out here, gathering stories, sights, moments of pure reckoning, moments of pure curiosity on the unchartable course. A clump of skunk, teeth bared and claws flared in an open grave. Bloodied deer bones strewn along a gullyway. Patches of green floaters coloring the tiny wintertime stream. A ring of cottonwoods framing the likes of an otherworld dancing circle. A hawk feather balanced atop the brittle golden grasses. Treasures all. And above them all is the ecstatic word spill that spills from my mouth like gleaming beads when I can no longer withhold it. And the heart gate's unhitched kiss I will give the woman at home who celebrates her union to a wild, and wilder still each season, man-creature.
Tim McLaughlin, the book is called Seeds Under the Tongue, and again, for those who are here in Santa Fe, you will be doing a book release this Sunday, the 21st of July at 4 in the afternoon at the Scottish Rite Temple, and people can just show up at that time and get their tickets.
They can show up, or they could go to my website, timothypmclaughlin.com, where tickets are available in advance. And it'll be a lovely mix of not just the poetry, but also some singing and wonderful dancing, flute playing, just a mix of things. So it's a beautiful theater, and we hope to celebrate, you know, the birth of this book.
Are you bringing your wife into it?
Yes, my wife and my oldest daughter are two of the singers.
Your wife, the incredible singer Madi Sato, and a teenage daughter who has inherited, I guess, a lot of her talents as well.
Yes, yeah, she's up and coming for sure, yeah. And then Esme Olivia is a beautiful singer and dancer. Maya Rose will be singing, and Walking Star Martinez will be there with his flute. So it's a beautiful mix, and we're all so connected.
And this poetry, I think, in many ways. I mean, it's wonderful to read, and I spent a long time with it. I mean, longer than it really should take to read a book of poetry, because I was like hearing it in my head and sometimes saying some of the words aloud. But the performance really brings it alive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was, in a lot of ways, I mean, it seems like you really wrote it to be performed.
You know, I mean, intoned for sure. I am devoted to the what I call the oral tradition, you know, meaning that poetry is an aural art, you know, to be enjoyed in the ear. And I don't think you have to be a scholar of poetry to appreciate and enjoy it, just like any great music. And I think of it as singing, really, singing the poems. So that's how they are born in me, is in, you know, like many poets, in a musical way. But I really feel that that's the way to share them with their source, you know. Yes, they're for all the humans, of course, but I really feel that, you know, the trees and the beasts love them. They don't need to think about them, but they really like hearing and sort of feeling what I'm doing. And, what I call ecstatic way, just heart-opened way of expressing and using language.
Tim McLaughlin, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
If you want to find out more about Tim's work, you can go to timothypmclaughlin.com, and you can also check out praisingearth.org. I will link to both of them at radiocafe.org/newmexican. Los Alamos National Laboratory Foundation moves public education in bold new directions through grants, programs, and advocacy. Growing local teachers and cultivating educational leadership, visit lanlfoundation.org for more information. The Radio Cafe and the Santa Fe New Mexican thank the Lanl Foundation for their support.